result of top stories, Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei urges officials to seriously address water shortage problems in the southwestern Khuzestan province, warning people against enemy's floods under such conditions. The Afghan government dismisses as, quote, absolute lie the Taliban's claim of controlling around 90% of the country's border. Also ahead, mourners in the city of Al-Quds hold a funeral for a Palestinian man who reportedly died due to torture in an Israeli jail. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called on officials to seriously address water shortage problems in the southwestern province of Khuzestan. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said the people of Khuzestan would not have faced such problems if authorities had taken previous advices. He called on people to be cautious given that the enemy is after misusing the situation against their interests and that of the Islamic Revolution. The leader made the comments after he received the second dose of domestically produced Coviran Barakat COVID vaccine. Ayatollah Khamenei thanked all those involved in producing the vaccine. He also criticized foreign nations for failing to fulfill their promises to provide Iran with vaccines. Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein says his country does not need U.S. combat troops anymore as it has its own forces on the ground. We discussed the U.S. military presence in Iraq earlier in our news review program. Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein says his country does not need any more U.S. combat troops as it has its own fighters. Hussein made the comment in an interview with Wall Street Journal. He said, what Iraq needs is cooperation in intelligence and training as well as Air Force support. Earlier this week, Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi also emphasized American combat troops should leave his country. He's set to meet with U.S. President Joe Biden on Monday in Washington. They're expected to issue a statement that calls for U.S. combat troops to leave Iraq by the end of the year. In January 2020, if you recall, Iraq's parliament issued a resolution demanding the expulsion of American forces. That followed the U.S. assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Joining me to discuss that issue in this news review will be first Mr. Saad al-Mutallabi. He is an independent politician from Baghdad, as well as Mr. Tim Anderson, a writer and director with the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies via Skype out of Sydney, Australia. Gentlemen, it's good to have you with us. Let's get the reaction to what I just read from Mr. Mutallabi in Baghdad. Mr. Mutallabi, what do you think about what has been said regarding the expulsion of the U.S. forces by foreign minister of your country, sir?
Thank you very much. There are two versions of events here. First version is that the parliament, as you clearly said, voted last year on the expulsion of the American troops. And the second version is that the Americans themselves, in their latest literature and communiques, are talking about withdrawing American troops from the Middle East as they did in Afghanistan. So it is understandable that the Americans need to withdraw their troops from Iraq, since we don't have any additional threats for the state of Iraq, either ISIS or any other dangers in the region. The Iraqi forces are sufficient enough with capabilities that are capable now of stopping any incursion or any attempt to attack Iraq. So therefore, I do believe that's a combination of two. And the foreign minister, Iraqi foreign minister, he was right in saying that the Iraqis do not need any more American troops on the ground, and only maybe intelligence assistance will be welcomed, and maybe some type of Air Force support. Other than that, I think it's not right to ask the Americans to stay as a fighting force in Iraq, since, as I said, we have enough trained people and enough equipment to face any future incursion. And the Americans also think that it is better for them to keep a better relationship between Iraq and the United States by pulling their troops out and not giving an excuse for the resistors to pound them with missiles every now and then. So it works on the benefits of two countries. Iraq will get rid of the Americans, and the Americans will maybe amend the relationship between Iraq and the United States.
Okay. Mr. Anderson and Sidley, what do you think about what's just been said, you know, both by the Prime Minister and our other guests from Baghdad itself? Do you think it's high time, or it's been actually past high time, that the American forces left Iraq altogether?
It's certainly past high time, but I'm afraid the headlines are rather misleading. If you read the detail here of what the Foreign Minister is talking about, and apparently he's setting up the scene for a statement, a joint statement on Monday when Mr. Al-Qadhimi is in Washington, is not about the withdrawal of US forces. There's quite a contradiction here with what the Parliament passed last year and what the government is doing. They are talking about combat troops leaving and training and intelligence and air power remaining there. Now, I don't think that's going to satisfy the resistance groups in Iraq, because they know very well the extent of betrayals of U.S. forces in the past.
Yeah, it was the combat troops that actually shot the entourage and the cars of both the commanders of Iran's both force, that particular division of Iran's IRGC, the Votes Force, Martyr Soleimani, as well as Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. And it was right after that that the parliament asked for the expulsion of those forces. If no combat troops remain on the ground, Mr. Mutallabi, if no combat troops remain on the ground, and only intelligence, like you said, or training, do you really think that the resistance would still be unhappy, like Mr. Anderson says?
No, I don't think so. I think if the Americans withdraw their fighting forces and the Air Force stop bombarding or attacking their PMWs, the PMUs, the public mobilization units, if they stop doing that, then there's no reason for the resistance to be unhappy. The demand for the resistance is that the Americans stop their aggression against Iraq. And having trainers or advisors, that is possibly will be welcomed.
All right. And Mr. Anderson, any final comments on that? You know, where do you think this is going? And it's very interesting, isn't it? And when you think about the same scenario happening in Afghanistan, you know, a while ago, just like Mr. Mutallabi said at the beginning, you also have the resurgence of the Taliban. To what extent, you know, given Iraq's situation, which is different in many respects, to what extent do you think that could be the scenario, one way or another, after, at least, like you said, combat troops leave Iraq?
I think they are. I think the occupation in Iraq, which is closely linked, by the way, to the occupation in Syria, is fragile. I think that more pressure is going to drive them out of Iraq and out of Syria. But in the meantime, I think we're looking at the way Mr. Hussein, the foreign minister, mentioned, is a joint statement affirming the presence of the U.S. In Iraq and in relation to intelligence and air power. And let's remember, when Daesh took over Mosul and was about to take over Baghdad, when Iraq was in a very desperate situation, they called for help. The U.S. was withholding their air power, was withholding aircraft that the Iraqi government had purchased. You know, so the betrayals go back a very long way, and I'm pretty sure that a lot of people in Iraq are not going to be happy with the statement that's coming up next Monday.
Mm-hmm. Many, many thanks. That's Mr. Tim Anderson, writer and director with the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies out of Sydney, Australia. I also had the pleasure of hosting Saad al-Mutallabi. He is an independent politician who joined us via satellite out of Baghdad. Gentlemen, you have a very good day wherever you are. Thank you very much for being with us. Welcome back. The Afghan government has rejected the Taliban's claim of controlling 90% of the country's border. The government said the claim is an absolute lie and baseless propaganda. The reaction came after a Taliban spokesman told
Russian media that the group is now in control of frontiers with Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and Iran. Taliban militants stepped up their attacks in May, taking different areas across Afghanistan. The U.S. estimates that those areas extend to over half of Afghanistan's district centers. Earlier, Russia deployed infantry groups to a Tajik military base near the Afghan border. Moscow warned that it will counter the militants if they enter the territory of Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, or Kyrgyzstan. Our Kabul correspondent Amin Alami says clashes have intensified between Afghan forces and the Taliban, while the government is under fire over its policies toward the group.
Recently, one of the Taliban spokespersons claimed that the militant group is controlling over 90% of the key border areas across Afghanistan, mainly border areas between Afghanistan and Uzbekistan, Afghanistan and Turkmenistan, as well as Iran and Tajikistan. But in the meantime, the Afghan presidential palace, as well as the Afghan defense ministry, strongly rejected this claim of the Taliban, saying that Afghan security forces, mainly Afghan police border forces, are stationed in those areas. And there are fightings in some areas on the border with Pakistan, mainly in southern Kandahar province of Afghanistan, where the Taliban militants recently launched a heavy-scale attack against Afghan security forces. They captured Isbin Buldak, which is a very key border area between Pakistan and Afghanistan in southern Afghanistan. And soon after the capture of this strategic area by the Taliban, the Afghan government forces launched a counterattack operation in southern Kandahar province and liberated Isbin Buldak from the Taliban. But let's not forget that Afghan security forces, mainly the Afghan National Army troops, are criticizing the war policy of the Afghan government, saying that they are facing very serious conditions and a bad situation during fightings with the Taliban.
Let's move on with another story. The Yemeni army and its allied forces from Ansarullah movement have carried out a large-scale operation against Saudi-backed militants in a border area. The operation has taken place on the outskirts of Jebel Adud, close to Saudi Arabia's southwestern region of Jizan. Footage released Thursday shows Yemeni troops pounding positions of Saudi-backed militants, including the Sudanese. A number of militants have been killed and many others arrested. The Yemenis have managed to take control of several districts. Saudi Arabia invaded Yemen in March 2015 to restore fugitive President Abdurrabbu Mansur Hadi. Since then, the kingdom has been supporting Hadi's loyalists who are fighting army personnel and their allied forces. Abdul Latif al-Washadi says the latest Yemeni operation is part of efforts to push Saudi Arabia towards a political solution to the long-running conflict. Take a listen.
The attack was on Al-Minzala and Al-Kamb Al-Qadim and Tabat Abbas on the strategic Jabal Adud. Yemeni army managed to kill and capture a large number of Sudanese soldiers. They were paid by Saudi Arabia. Four military vehicles were destroyed in the operation, and the Saudi Air Force tried to support the troops on the ground, but the Yemeni army managed to take control of a number of districts and military sites, and the Yemeni army burned the camps and barricades of the Saudi-backed forces. After the major victory in Al-Baydaqin against Al-Qaeda and Daesh, the Yemeni army managed to launch a larger and wide-scale operation on the Yemeni borders to keep pushing the kingdom to the political solution, one way or another.
Mourners have laid to rest a Palestinian prisoner who was found dead in an Israeli jail in the city of Al-Quds Thursday. The funeral for Abdul Yusuf al-Khatib al-Tamimi was held at the Al-Aqsa Mosque under conditions imposed by Israeli authorities. Palestinian media reports suggest that al-Tamimi succumbed to torture while in custody. They say Israeli prison staff severely beat him and used electric shock against him. Tamimi's family has rejected Israeli officials' claim that he had died of a heart attack. was among thousands of Palestinians languishing in Israeli prisons, many of them held without any charges. Rights groups say they are denied proper conditions and are subject to systemic torture. Israel is struggling to find a way to contain a deepening scandal caused by revelations that it helped repressive regimes in the region to spy on their critics. Such collaboration has been ongoing since 2016.
The Israeli regime is in hot water over a major scandal triggered by revelations that an Israeli-made spyware has been sold to some governments to target journalists, dissidents, and political leaders. Data leaked to an international alliance of news outlets shows the Pegasus spyware was sold to a group of countries, including the repressive regimes of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates, which have notorious human rights records. It has been disclosed that Israel's Ministry of Military Affairs played an important role in choosing the customers that can buy the cutting-edge cyber spying tool. Some sources say Israeli authorities pushed for Saudi Arabia to be added to the list of customers that get the spyware. International pressure is mounting on Israel for enabling gross abuses by approving export licenses for the powerful spying tool to these states. Why was Tel Aviv so eager to make sure regimes like Saudi Arabia will have the sophisticated tool?
It helps them to control their countries. It helps to get them to be on the same side as Israel, because that's typically repressive regimes find Israel to be a, you can call it a good alliance, if you will. So this is what's happening, and it's happening now with the repressive Arab regimes in a way that it did not happen in the past.
U.S. media recently reported that Israel encouraged the technology company that developed Pegasus to continue to cooperate with the Saudis even after it was revealed that the regime ordered and planned the gruesome assassination of outspoken journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. The Israeli regime seems to be trying to control damage from the scandal. It has set up a task force to manage the fallout from the revelations amid an international outcry.
And that's it with international news.
English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khomeini guided the Iranian nation to determine their own fate, June 4, 2021. A televised speech delivered on June 4, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. Greetings be upon him. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to God, the Lord of the worlds. And peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure household, especially the one remaining with God on earth. Another 14th of Khordad is upon us, and the public environment of the country has become imbued with the memory of that great personality, that great man, that irreplaceable leader, that tender heart, that iron fist, that unwavering determination, that deep and bright faith, and that wise and insightful sage. Today and for many years to come in distant futures, our nation and our country need to guard this dear memory and remembrance. The Islamic Republic, Imam's most important innovation. What I want to discuss with our dear nation today is about our magnanimous Imam's most important innovation. He was the architect of many innovations, but this one was his most important innovation, the innovation of establishing the Islamic Republic. That was our magnanimous Imam's innovation, which is synonymous with religious democracy, which was formalized under the title of the Islamic Republic, and which turned into a system originating from the thoughts and willpower of the Iranian nation and from the leadership of our magnanimous Imam. Imam's decisiveness and the Islamic Republic's victories silenced the enemies. I would like to start the discussion by saying that among political systems in the world, including revolutionary systems and those established in the last one, two centuries, I do not know of any system that has been subject to as many predictions about its destruction, eradication, and overthrow as the Islamic Republic. Since the first day when the Islamic Republic was formed, ill-intentioned personalities, enemies, and those inside and outside the country who could not digest and tolerate that great phenomena said that the Islamic Republic would not survive more than 2 months, and sometimes they said that it would not survive more than 6 months.
In May, tensions in occupied Palestine escalated and the Israeli occupation launched yet another deadly war on Gaza. This assault, as well as the threat of expulsion of Palestinians from occupied East Al-Quds and the Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan, which triggered Palestinian protests, are all just another chapter in the 73-year-old Palestinian Nakba. But these events demonstrate something very important: the failure of the normalization deals, the so-called Abraham Accords, or the deal of the century between four Arab countries and Israel, concluded in 2020. These agreements were heavily advertised as promoting peace in West Asia and reining in Israeli expansionist policies in Palestine. But as anticipated, they have proven to have failed in both. The announcement of the normalization of ties with Israel came laden with promises that it will help bring peace to Palestine. but a stop to the Israeli plan to annex parts of the occupied West Bank and supposedly open the door to economic development for the entire region. But what has transpired since has proven that these agreements were a mere business transaction steered by former U.S. President Donald Trump, who did all he could to accommodate all of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's whims. The main outcome of the normalization deals is that the UAE is set to become a major trading partner for Israel after it abandoned the decades-old Arab boycott of Israel. Economic relations between Bahrain and Israel are also likely to intensify. Nothing for Sudan and Morocco, though, except the two countries are set to reap the benefits of their own small political wins facilitated by the U.S. easing its sanctions. None of these deals changed the situation on the ground in the region's hot spots, particularly in Palestine, as the events of the past few months demonstrate. Israel continues to be engaged in systematic ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in Gaza, pass state laws that discriminate against non-Jews as they trample over Palestinians' religious rights, and continue to threaten native Palestinians with forced expulsion from their homes. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Over the past few months, tensions in Palestine have escalated as the Israeli occupation launched yet another deadly war on Gaza. This aggression, as well as the threat of displacing Palestinian natives from occupied East Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, and the Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan, which, by the way, triggered a lot of Palestinian protests, were a demonstration of the failure of the so-called normalization deals, or the deal of the century, between four Arab countries and Israel. These agreements were heavily advertised as promoting peace in the Middle East and reining in Israeli expansionist policies inside of Palestine, but they have proven to have failed in both. To discuss this issue with us from Madrid is Alberto Garcia Watson, journalist and political commentator. Thank you for being with us. Alberto, now the ongoing Israeli aggression against Palestinians demonstrates that the normalization deals have basically just failed between these four Arab states and the Israeli entity. But why were these deals brokered then, if not for peace?
Because actually it was never intended to be for peace. It was actually expected that this last attack on Gaza was going to take place, and there were all the time threatening with Gaza and the resistance groups with a major attack. So, however, this was a kind of distraction campaign to try to keep everyone distracted with the struggle for peace of the Americans and the Israelis. But it was never intended to be. It was never an intention of actually bringing peace to the region. As I said, it was just a distraction. And these countries, unfortunately, went for it. And they went for it because they were also bribed. Because of, in the case of Morocco, it was the sovereignty of Morocco over the Occidental Sahara, which was a territory under the control of the Spaniards. When it comes to Sudan, but also different bribes given to that country, and also Bahrain, and we'll see other countries that will move in too. So it's actually never intended to bring peace to the region, and as I see very clearly, the intention of making out of Palestine a kind of an autonomous region under the control and the security of Israel will never be accepted by Palestinians.
Well, Alberto, Israel continued after the deals its engagement in Palestinian ethnic cleansing and in bringing out laws that discriminate against whoever is not Jew, and by discriminating also against the religious practices of Palestinians, whether they are Muslims or Christians. They even tried to displace people within the occupied Al-Quds Sharif. We have been seeing that since May in the occupied Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. One blockaded, carpet-bombed Gaza was able to stop them, was able to halt the Israeli expansionist plan and their aggression against the occupied territories. Will the sides involved in this deal be able to salvage what is left of it after what happened with Gaza?
What happened with Gaza was an attention that the resistance sent very clear after crossing the red lines that are Haram al-Sharif, the compound of the Al-Aqsa Mosque that was desecrated by settlers and militaries, and the attempt on evacuating the population of Sheikh al-Jarrah, and what they're doing, for example, now with Sirwan. Resistance made it very clear. There are red lines that the Israelis cannot cross, and they've learned under this last conflict with Gaza that basically the Israelis can not only have Mahmoud Abbas as a reference to deal with, but they're going to have to deal with the resistance, because everything is pointing at the power that the resistance now has will put Israel in its place. So that's why the deal of the century is never going to get through while the resistance is active, and the resistance has shown that they're going to rule from now on any opposition to the brutal occupation of the Israeli entity.
It was truly interesting, Alberto, to see Israeli far-right groups who feel emboldened by their electoral alliance with the new Prime Minister Bennett, who also stepped up harassment against the Palestinians, if I may. Some of them marched in Jerusalem a couple of weeks back, and they were chanting death to Arabs, and the entire world was watching them. But how do you think the latest Palestinian revolt, whether in Al-Quds or in the occupied West Bank, will maybe further affect the scene inside the Palestinian territories, especially after the assassination of a very prominent activist like Nizar Banat and the arrest of several others?
Well, what we saw that day, the day that the Israelis called the Day of the Flag in Jerusalem, it was not just assassinate and kill the Arabs. There were some groups that even went as far as chanting, tonight we're not Jews, tonight we are Nazis. That far they got. And this provocation that actually was allowed even by the Israeli authorities gave very much the knowledge of what is the mentality of the new government that is basically created by different groups of radicals, especially extreme radical Jews that are in this government, and that are trying to see how far they can get and how far can the Palestinians take it. What happened also with the Nizar Banat, the killing of Nizar Banat by the Palestinian National Authority, because of denouncing the collaborationism of Abbas with Israelis, it's putting a lot of Palestinians today in the territories, especially in Jerusalem and the rest of the West Bank, against the president Mahmoud Abbas, that there shouldn't even be a president at this point, because it's already years ago that he should have been out of power.
Well, after the victories, Alberto, of the Al-Quds sword operation, all allied forces of the resistance in the region, going from Beirut to Damascus to Baghdad to Tehran to Sana'a, they all voiced their support and their readiness to engage in order to support and fight back the Zionist entity from Al-Quds al-Sharif. How viable do you think this new equation in reality is?
Well, the new equation, if you let me share a fact with you, is that in the last year, 50,000 Israelis have left Israel, and they have asked for dual citizenship, especially in Europe and the United States, and Russia and other countries, because the big dream of the Zionists was actually to find a home, a national home, for the Jews that were prosecuted around the world, and a place where they could feel secure. Today, Israelis do not feel secure anymore. Today, the Israelis are starting to feel what many Palestinians have been suffering for the past seven decades, and it's terror and it's fear. It's not stability in the country, and it's definitely not security. And this is one of the achievements of the resistance, and is that the fear has changed sides.
I want to thank you very much, Alberto Garcia Watson, journalist and political commentator, for joining us to talk about the failure of the deal of the century, especially after the latest Israeli assault on Gaza and the occupied internal Palestinian territories. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about how the U.S. continues to demonize the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The demonization of Iran is now a well-established reality of American contemporary politics. It's a clear mistake, yet the U.S. continues to trap itself in a perpetual Middle East conflict. Over the past 42 years, the U.S. decided that Iran needs to be classified as an evil power. That inclination makes it very difficult for the American regime to come to a resound understanding of how they got so deeply tangled in the Persian Gulf and how it is that they would end up basically in the pocket of the Saudis. Maybe it's about time the U.S. acted reasonable to at least acknowledge that Iran has its own security interests and will not allow anyone to tamper with it. More in the following report.
Imagine an Iranian drone had been shot down over Florida or just off its coast. Rather than arguing about its exact position, we would surely be shocked at its presence almost 7,000 miles from Iran. But on June 20, 2019, Iran downed a U.S. drone that had violated its airspace, and almost nobody asked if the U.S. military presence in the Persian Gulf was even justified. It is truly appalling how the U.S. regime does not fathom the current escalation between the United States and Iran, presenting Iran as a threat, nuclear or otherwise, over and over again, carries the clear message that it must be confronted. It's much more accurate to say that the U.S. is a threat to Iran than the opposite. After all, it's the U.S. government that is destroying Iran's economy through sanctions that limit Iranians' access to food and medicine while surrounding Iran with military bases and land, sea, and air forces. Iran has done nothing remotely comparable as opposed to the constant U.S. warmongering hegemony. This inversion of reality, which favors U.S. military might, is strengthened by selective political memory and by the media's lies of omission. Who in the West remembers Iran Air Flight 655? On July 3, 1988, the USS Vincennes, patrolling in Iranian territorial waters, downed an airliner with 290 civilian passengers en route for Dubai. The United States initially denied responsibility, then claimed that the Vincennes was in international waters and that the Airbus, which it had mistaken for a fighter jet, was descending toward it in a threatening manner. The United States later admitted that both statements were untrue. And just like that, Flight 655 was soon forgotten in the media, except in Iran. American News Business works on hating Iran and promoting the latest lies of the Pentagon to attain or maintain a position of authority in the U.S. The demonization of Iran is truly the most bizarre and self-defeating of all U.S. foreign policies. Americans view Iran not simply as a country with interests that sometimes conflict with their own, but as a relentless font of evil. American politicians rarely speak that way about any other country. Iran occupies a unique place in U.S. pantheon of enemies simply because the Islamic Republic of Iran is a sovereign nation.
Now to discuss this issue with us from London is Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire. Thank you very much for being with us, Patrick. Now, the demonization of Iran is now a very well-established reality in U.S. contemporary politics, just as once Vietnam and Afghanistan were, despite the fact that the U.S. engaged in war with them and came out defeated. Shouldn't that be lesson number one for them to change completely their foreign policy with the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Unfortunately, successive U.S. administrations haven't really looked to history for any of these sort of lessons. At the moment, the U.S., Washington's just generally still in denial of its own debacles, denial of just, you know, how things have developed in the region and how things have moved forward since 2003. It's a very different Middle East than it was when the U.S. bombed and invaded Iraq. A new arc of resistance has formed, and it's formed as a direct result of Western interventions, and probably one of the biggest factors of that right now would be what's happened in Syria over the last decade now. It's 10 years, really, since that proxy war has been prosecuted against Syria and its allies, and Iran is front and center in that conflict. It's come to the aid of its allies in Syria. What it wants is stability in the region. It doesn't want to see another state, certainly not an ally, be dismembered by foreign countries that are ganging up, as it were, on Syria. The same thing has happened in Yemen as well. So, you know, you can look at it from that point of view. Certainly the U.S. rushes to protect its allies and reserves that as its sovereign right as a nation state to act in its interest, its national or geopolitical interest, or in self-defense.
Patrick, we did see the U.S. attacking Syria and Iraq several times, and every time it did so, it cited that it was targeting so-called Iranian mercenaries or Iranian militias, despite the fact that it was Syrian Arab army who were being murdered and Iraqi Hashd al-Shaabi fighters who were also being martyred by these strikes. How come the American public does not even question the sustainability of such attacks or even question what the U.S. is doing there, despite the fact that it will backfire on their boys and girls, daughters and sons in the U.S. Army in those military bases in those regions?
In general, the American public has no idea what's happened, let alone any of these recent airstrikes or anything really of the last few years for that matter. Why and what the implications are going forward, because that's the important thing. What are the implications of these airstrikes? And it's really just pulling the United States further and further down a rabbit hole that it really doesn't have any plan how to navigate, let alone get out of. Going forward. So effectively, U.S. forces are really mercenary forces right now. And whose interests are they really defending? Specifically, when we're talking about the Syrian-Iraqi border, they're really defending the interests, strategic interests of Israel or of the Gulf states. So defending their strategic interests, not the U.S.'s per se. Mm-hmm. And so the Hashd al-Shaabi, the People's Mobilization Units, they're constantly mischaracterized in the U.S. or in the West as Iranian-backed militias, and they actually fall under the Iraqi Ministry of Defense. They are effectively part of the Iraqi armed forces, and they've done all the heavy lifting in the fight against ISIS on the ground, and they really defeated ISIS from that effort. And around October of 2017, you could say they could declare victory over ISIS at that time, but that's completely expunged from the record in the Western media, in the narratives that are running through politics and media in the West, and hence nobody really understands, A, why they're there, what's happening there, and how to get out gracefully.
Just a regular policy of omitting news from U.S. media, but the U.S. Regime has a narrative that describes U.S.-Iranian relations that dates back to the hostage situation of the late 70s. Now, the U.S. narrative doesn't include anything that happened before that, not even the CIA's overthrow of Iranian President Mossadegh back in early 1950s. What would it really take to change this hegemonic approach of the U.S., consecutive U.S. administrations against the Islamic Republic of Iran? Is it basically war what they want? Is it just in reality? Do they want a confrontation with Iran?
It's a very difficult position, a very difficult phase of this situation right now. You could say a war from a Western perspective is going to underline and define the paradigm going forward. So they're in a kind of a limbo at the moment in terms of their purpose. Okay, but it will take a major embarrassment or a major defeat. I mean, the United States' position is very weak in Iraq, per se, right now. And just generally, it's very weak in the region. I mean, the missile attacks on Al-Nasad Air Base and in Erbil in January of 2020, that should have really sent a message to Washington as to how weak their position is, pulling out of Qatar, the major U.S. equipment, forces, and so forth, relocating, rearranging the pieces on the chessboard. So will it take a Saigon moment in Iraq? Certainly that's, we're having a view of what that might look like in Afghanistan right now.
Mm-hmm.
This could be the same situation in Iraq when you've overstayed your time there, and certainly I think they have. They're trying to get leverage right now for the Iran nuclear deal. That seems to be all that's left on the table for the U.S. or to renegotiate the missile treaty internationally with Russia, throw Iran in the mix mm-hmm. there, and then walk away with some kind of a victory there. But again, it's really down to what Israel wants when you're talking about Washington.
Well, the U.S. can claim the prerogative of waging war against whoever it wants, just like George W. Bush, who implemented the claim by invading Iraq in 2003, and he put a list of West Asian countries that he wanted to go after, one after the other, and we did see how that was going on over the past 12 to 15 years. Do the Americans really believe that such states will hear that and wait there for the war to happen? I mean, least that Iran could do is put forth a strategic plan to defend itself, its interests, its perimeter. When will the U.S. regime just hold its horses and realize that there is no longer a unipolar political world out there?
Yeah, and it's not only that in terms of the polarization that exists. Really, one of the main reasons is because of its sort of a blanket policy of sanctions against multiple countries right now in the Middle East. You're looking at Syria, Iran, also Yemen as well. So sanctions is an act of war. That's just going to permanently polarize the situation in the region as well. But you know, take the JCPOA, for instance, that began to degrade under President Obama because the U.S. did not adhere to its commitments with the Iran nuclear deal, much like the Trump administration, who basically backed out of it and really finalized it, something that was already collapsing. So the U.S. and the EU did not even bother to honor their international commitments on this. So that was, I believe, a fatal mistake, which I think is triggering what looks like a slow-motion collapse mm-hmm. In U.S. hegemony right now. So this degraded status will eventually reverberate to its Israeli allies, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and the rest of the Gulf as well. This is already happening as we speak. So, and again, it's just because the U.S.'s position and its allies is absolutely untenable, as are the policies. And I think the world at large is beginning to see this as well.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire, for joining us from London to discuss this issue with us. Thank you very much for being with us. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality. Back to
it's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Back to Reality with me, Muhammad Javad, and my two guests. Let me ask them actually to introduce themselves first.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I'm Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi, and I'm glad to be here with you guys.
Thank you very much. And, sister?
I'm Radia Shamili,
At your service.
Well, who's the person behind a sword with two edges?
The love of my heart. It belongs to our imam, our first Shiite imam, Imam Ali alayhi salam.
What do you think of a sermon without Aleph?
It shows how talented he was, what a smart individual Ali alayhi salam was, or how God Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala had gifted him.
Those who are not Shia, for example, or
an
not Muslims, when they read such a thing, it hits them really hard. Like George Durdiak, the guy who wrote The Voice of Justice, or, you know, by Imam Ali alayhi salam. He was a Christian, but he wrote like 3 or 4 books about Imam Ali. I remember his story. Said, I used to run away from school, and I take Najd Balagha, and I used to hide behind the wall and read Najd Balagha. He was just a kid.
Wow.
Yeah, he was in his early, you know, he was in primary school or not even high school. He said,
very
I used to run away and read Najd Balagha because it was captivating. So to me, and he was like, what is letters, you know, a sermon without letters? Obviously, to Ali is nothing, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, if you remove the veils, it would not increase my certainty. That's how we look at Ali alayhi salam.
Right. Could you share with us a quote which is unique in your point of view from Imam Ali?
You just asked me for the impossible. it's like you know, like we have a term, says بعد الأناء أسر الماء بالماء. Like when they ask him what is water, he pondered for a minute or an hour. It's like, water is water.
Yeah.
It's like, how am I supposed to tell you which is the best speech of Ali alayhi salam when all his speeches are just...
Yes, I know most of them are like captivating, as
but
you
see,
pointed out. But
yeah.
But what is it that caught you like...
The thing that I live by, let's say, the thing that I live by, this is a short saying of Amir Amin that I personally live by, is the one that he says, كُنْ كَالْإِبْنِ اللَّبُونَ لَا ظَهْرٌ فَيُرْكَبْ وَلَا ظَرْءٌ فَيُحْلَبْ. It's basically, it's an antidote to live a life where you're safe. Be like a baby camel, that if someone rides the back, will break it, and does not have breast and cannot give milk. Like they're trying to milk a baby come, obviously does not give. So if you put yourself in a state in life, or a new community or a new society, where you act like this little camel, either they will break your back or either they will take whatever you have. Don't be in that state. So which means what? Which means constantly be aware of your surrounding, be who you are, be aware of who you are, be aware of what you say, be aware of your surrounding, which gives you that complete package to live a life where you are constantly aware. So this is something I live by, but you know, everyone could relate to Imam Ali alayhi salam in his own way. But as sermon-wise goes, each field, it would have a specific sermon. For example, if you tell me about taqwa, right? I say, okay, obviously the sermon of muttaqin kills it. Right? If you talk about Imam Ali's pain, khutbat al-shaykh shaqiyya kills it.
Yes.
When you talk about advices, or for example, letters that he delivered to his you know, his governors, the letter of Malik al-Ashraf kills it, right? And so on. So each specific, if you specify like categories for me, I will give you which one is the killer of them. You know what I mean? But in general, each one has to, I think, find the soft spot that hits him when it comes to Amir al-Mu'minin and his sermons and words.
Yes. And a word of also caution is advice, because some of these words are like very deep and complicated, and
not just very deep
they
and
could
complicated.
Be easily
they carry,
abused
they,
too.
They carry two meanings. Some
exactly.
of them carry three meanings.
Yes, exactly.
So like you look at it, it gives you one meaning. You take a step back, it gives you another meaning.
Mm-hmm.
You dive in and gives you a third. So look at the context of what Imam Ali is trying to say, where he's saying it, to whom he's saying it. He's speaking about a specific woman. So you have to be very careful, like I said, with the words of Amir al-Mu'minin.
Yes. Okay, sister, is there any quote from Ali that captivated you? Like, the most, or it was like aced it.
Yeah, it's his letter to his son, Imam Hassan. You can analyze it from different perspectives, but from the perspective, because the topic of responsible fatherhood has been a topic that has become very famous in the past 3-4 decades. And fathers and raising a child is something that mostly people know as the responsibility of a mother. And when you go into the teachings of Islam, you see that the duty of raising, you know, the spiritual well-being of a child lies, you know, on the, like, is in the hands of the father of the child. where in the noble verses of the Quran you say Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says "Qu anfusakum wa ahlikum nara," and after that when the verse was revealed, people came to the Prophet and, you know, one of them started crying and said, "Oh my God, what am I supposed to do? I had the difficulty of, you know, keeping my own faith, and now the responsibility of, you know, the well-being of my family, my children in the other world is laid upon my shoulders." So, you know, so from this, you find out that maybe the customs and the culture of the Muslims is not exactly what the teachings of Islam is with regards to the realm of fatherhood. And then when I had this concern in my mind, and I went through this Rasalat al-Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, and I read, you know, the rights of a child upon the father, and then all the different hadith that we have from the Prophet and the infallibles about the role of the father. And I found this letter from Imam Ali alayhi salam to his son to be including what responsible fatherhood really entails in the religion of Islam.
Right. Okay, before we go on and continue our discussion, let's take a short break and we'll be back.
فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي.
It's his letter to his son, Imam Hassan. I'm just going to read like one paragraph of it for you guys, share it with you.
I appreciate it.
He says, "Give up discussing what you do not know and speaking about what does not concern you. Keep off track from which you fear to go astray, because refraining from moving when fear of staying is better than embarking on dangers. Ask others to do good. You will thus be among good doers. Desist others from evil with your action as well as your speech, and keep off." You see, these are, if only you would pay attention to two or three sentences of these, and if you act upon these sentences in your life, they would be life-changing.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, we just pay lip service to the instructions and the teachings that we have, and we are very good orators, good lecturers, but we fall behind when it comes to practice.
Sayyid Abdullah, do you remember an interesting story about Imam Ali's life?
I'll tell you the story of Roger Garudi, if you heard of him, the French philosopher. He's recent, like in the last, I don't know, 30 years. He was teaching in university, and he constantly mentions Ali alayhi salam in his speeches. One of his students after class, she came to him, she said to him, "Why do you always talk about a person called Ali? Why do you always refer to him? Why do you always quote him? Who is this Ali?" He said to her, "I'll tell you who Ali is." He said to her, "But first, if you were hit by a car, what would happen to you?" She said to him, "Either I die or I get unconscious. Like I lose, you know, I go in coma." He says to her, "Ali was hit on a sword on his head, and the sword made it to the middle of his brain. Right?
Yes.
Yet, which is the brain," he said to her, "the brain represents logic and intellect. If it's cut, you're a vegetable. Right?"
Yes.
He said, "This man on his bed, he wrote the most eloquent letter to his son," which this is what I was talking about, "of how to live your life. You know, he spoke about death, he spoke about being nice to you. Children, not to your neighbors, and so on and so forth." And then he says, "You see the love of Ali towards his enemy, because Imam Ali salam, he said what? He said to his son Hassan alayhi salam, he said, 'My enemy, feed him what you eat, give him what you drink.'" He said, "What kind of person with that sword in the middle of his head would talk like this?" He said, by the time he finished saying this words to her, she was in tears.
Wow. Who's this guy, this person from Lebanon who wrote so much about
Imam Ali? We mentioned him before.
Yeah.
Why
with so much talk